Welcome to this week's Reaction podcast with me, Alistair Benn, news editor, Ian Martin, editor of Reaction, and Finn McRedmond, a member of the Reaction team. Where are we, Ian, this week?
You mean on Brexit and Boris?
Physically, where are we? I was meant to introduce that, so... We're going to talk about Boris, Boris Johnson,
yeah,
Bojo, Brexit.
But we are in the Café Paradiso in Shad Thames, Bermondsey in London, after attempting to do a podcast last week in a pub. We're trying out some other venues because we don't want the studio or anything.
Yeah, and it was too raucous last week, I think.
What was
we got too Eurosceptic.
You were more Eurosceptic than me, which was quite extraordinary.
I came away, I spent the whole weekend worried.
Really?
Worried that my friends would find out, you know.
Well, did anything bad happen after it?
Oh, no.
So as you can hear there from the sound of coffee being made, we are in a fantastic Italian cafe. We're talking firstly about Boris. So where are we in terms of all of that? Total shambles. Finn wrote a piece for the site identifying that this is, of course, a total and utter mystery. How on earth this leaked tape of them battling for Brexit and being robust and patriotic and all the rest of it managed to find its way into the press, but somehow it did. It's been a week of total chaos and shambles and arguing on Brexit. A lot has happened. What does it all add up to? Not very much, because after a week of the Brits arguing about the backstop, Michel Barnier and the European Union or the European Commission said, well, they wouldn't accept anyway what the Brits had compromised on. So, yet more shambles. Is that a fair summary, Alistair?
Well, it's kind of chimes with what I was saying in the pub last night, is that, here's my pub talk on it, is that it's become a kind of a fine kind of performance art, this Brexit stuff. It's that the government moves its position very slightly. The opposition, you know, Corbyn does a similar move in another direction. Everyone spends a week arguing about it in the British press as if there's like a consistent reality there that they're talking about. And then the European Commission just says, oh, but none of that's real at all. That's never going to happen. And that's what's so weird about it. None of it's happening. It's just David Davis.
It's quite like a Beckett play or a Seinfeld where there's toing and froing, and at the end of the day you look back and just nothing's changed.
Nothing happened. So waiting for Bojo. Do you think they've been? Do you think he knew what he was doing, and that the sound bites read as though they're crafted?
Yeah,
as
I think
they can be with Boris.
I think the most telling thing about it is the timing. You know, the day after David Davis's resignation threats, which actually incidentally I read in Independent today, David Davis now threatened to resign 5 times. So after the 5th threat to resign, you know, Theresa May is already looking a bit shaky. The week's not been great. She's desperately trying to hold her cabinet together, and then Bojo comes in from the side. You know, so I think that's what's really telling about it. And the, you know, those lovely sound bites, like how the Treasury is the Remain stronghold, were very smart, interesting anyway.
But then David Davis did threaten to, or left hanging the notion that he would resign, didn't resign in the end. From Davis's team's point of view, what he was trying to do was ensure that Theresa May didn't allow the European Union to get the UK into a position where this thing called the backstop, which almost no one involved, almost no one sensible in the country even really understands or is paying attention to. But the idea that the backstop, that Britain effectively staying within the customs union and complying with single market rules, could go on in perpetuity. And according to Davis's people, the confrontation with May means that that won't be the case, and that penciled in is December 2021 if it comes to it. Now, that's fine, but then the European Union, as I pointed out earlier, says nonsense and says, well, the backstop doesn't apply to the whole of the UK anyway, it only applies to Northern Ireland, which is, from a Brexiteer point of view, is once again the European Union trying to divide the UK and split off Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK, which is not sustainable.
God, 2021, it's going to be the roaring 20s. I'm really looking forward to the 20s. I think they're going to be great. It's going to be a great time for culture and liberation.
And possibly a united Ireland.
Great, oh, yeah, potentially.
Do you mean in the kind of Weimar vibe?
Disintegration? Yeah, it'll be an enormous opening up. But no, it's back. So what is a backstop? Is that position in cricket behind the batsman.
Yep.
And you've got your fastest bowler, and you normally use it when you're about 12 years old and you need someone to just stand there, and he's the worst fielder. But, you know, I'm trying to work out a comparison. But
then my frustration, and what we don't know...
Do you need a backstop at like a fallback position like that? Or would you argue that it's...
I wouldn't have started from here, but the argument is that you do, because that's what the UK agreed to at the European Council at the talks with the European Commission in December.
Okay.
And that having signed up to that, Britain has to find some form of fallback position. It's now become so confused. It's kind of in the hands of the officials, who I feel slightly sorry for in certain respects, in that it's falling to them to try and sort it out. Mm. It's just turning into this kind of Brexit mush, which no one can really understand or explain. And if the point is there should be some compromises, I just wish she would say, these are the compromises, this is what it looks like. Don't think anyone else has a better idea or votes to get a better idea through Parliament. So this is it.
Okay.
But she's incapable of doing that, because that involves leadership.
Yeah. Bye. Yeah, well, talking of leadership, do you think Boris's intervention is a substantial pitch for a different view, or is it kind of Boris just sounding off to muddy the waters? What's his end game with it?
So there are two... It's difficult to know precisely what's going on inside his head, but there are two interpretations doing the rounds at Westminster. The first is, this is all hot air. This is just Boris trying to show, for the benefit of history, that he was arguing for something different. Then there is another school of thought which says, actually, he's so frustrated, and he's not alone in this, he's so frustrated by the lack of progress and by the way in which officials and the Prime Minister are dragging their heels, that this is an intervention designed to really indicate that he will go further when it comes to it. So lots of people say, well, he won't resign. I wonder if that's really what he's building up to. If David Davis had resigned this week, it would, for all the joking about it and about, you know, his threats to resign, if he had done it, I think it probably would have been the end of the Prime Minister. And because to lose Brexit negotiator, the lot of Tory pro-Brexit MPs having quite a bit of faith in David Davis, or certainly thinking he's in a difficult position, who would then have taken over from him? Who would she have persuaded to take on this rather difficult task? So his not resigning is really was a, ironically was it an attempt to prop her up. I know that sounds tricky, I know that sounds ludicrous, because this is all about a crisis, a fight between Davis and May, but I think, and as I understand it from friends of David Davis, his resignation was primarily about the fear of, his lack of resignation was primarily about the fear about what would happen if she did go. And you would then set off a chain of events, potential leadership contest, where who knows what you end up with. I personally don't buy that. I just think I've said for the last year since the election, which is the anniversary of which, so we should reflect on that
today
a little bit. Yeah. I just think it's been apparent since then and even before then that she can't do it and that she is not in her natural milieu and she's not the Prime Minister. And I think that is keeps coming back to the fact that we're trying to do one of the most difficult things we've done in our post-war history without a functioning Prime Minister. People go on about Thatcher and Thatcher and Churchill. Well, you know, a Callaghan would be good. Someone wily like that, or a Healy would have been good, or goodness, or that chap David Cameron, he might have been okay. But
it'd be interesting to think about who would be an even worse historical Prime Minister to be taking on Brexit. Would Gordon Brown have been even worse or pretty better?
Well, he wouldn't have ever found himself in a situation where
Ramsay MacDonald, you know.
Yeah, that's a given. But Brown would not have found himself in a situation where he was delivering Brexit. I don't think. Well, maybe he inherited a sort of Tory shambles and then became Prime Minister. Yeah, he was pretty thorough and organised. I'm not a Brown fan, but in administrative terms, he could sometimes be indecisive and a bit chaotic. But ultimately, he knew how government worked. No, it's a good question. Almost anyone would be better, I think.
Was it John Major being better?
No, because certainly in terms of the basic practicalities of managing the talks, but then Major is a major component of the Remain campaign or sort of stop Brexit.
So a year on from the election, what do you think, Finn? Where were the Tory party going and what happened afterwards? And
I think the thing that's most interesting to reflect on the year anniversary is the DUP and the massive impact that's had.
Yeah.
Especially because it's kind of absurd that by virtue of having a quite poor results in the election, this strange woman from Fermanagh, Arlene Foster, was just skyrocketed to have this huge amount of leverage over a government where, you know, she would have been deeply, you know, backbencher, irrelevant MP otherwise. And she's really, grandstanding a lot all year, really putting her foot down, being difficult, both with Theresa May and with Leo Varadkar in Dublin. And I think there was probably no other option to Theresa May at that time, but I think she's probably massively regretting it. And
do you think?
Yeah, I think so.
I just wonder whether the problem, and we've seen it this week, you wrote a good piece about Northern Ireland and abortion in the light of the campaign there's been this week in London at Westminster to try and force Northern Ireland to get in line with English and Welsh law on abortion. The thing that struck me about that was just how many people at Westminster didn't really no longer have a feel for Northern Ireland, or just couldn't see how, put to one side whatever one's views are on the substance of the issue, just couldn't see the potential for political disaster in a set of circumstances where the Tory government relies on the votes of the DUP but is now going to attempt to try and tell the DUP what to do on abortion. It doesn't seem very sensible.
Yeah, I think there was a complete lack of...
You understand that people are viscerally responding to the Ireland vote, and that's why it's come up. It's not just people... You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that's what the main consideration is.
Sure.
You know, that's happened and Northern Ireland is now an anomaly.
I think there's been...
But no, there's sensitivities.
There's been a lack of interrogation among all the political class about what devolution means and what it's there for and why it's important. And as I said in the piece, devolution exists to maintain this union between Northern Ireland and, you know, the rest of the United Kingdom, but also between this power, this supply and the supply, what do you call it?
Confidence and supply
between Theresa May and Arlene Foster, but still allow for the regional specificities of Northern Ireland. And there's been a complete lack of respect for that idea. And I think it's quite outrageous of May and Greening and Amber Rudd to appear to be holding these secret meetings about how they're going to, you know, leverage abortion in Northern Ireland. And yeah, a lack of respect for the way that the union actually functions on the basis of devolution and whether it is right or wrong. Abortion is a devolved power, and it's not for Justin Greening and Amber Rudd to be, yes, you know, getting their fingers in.
But the other curiosity about it, which is that, and there's a tension here, isn't there? Because a certain kind of all Ireland, and I'm a unionist, but an all Ireland cultural feeling or identity has developed since, has become more apparent, has been strengthened since the Good Friday Agreement. Now, it's always been there. It's what a friend of mine from the Republic used to term rugby union, Irish, all-Ireland patriotism, the idea of one team, one island. For obvious reasons, a concept that was, you know, not much in evidence during the Troubles. But that's slowly come back, really quite apparent on both sides of the border. So that is potentially, that's at risk, or that explains why some people in Northern Ireland might feel a closer connection than they would have done 30 or 40 years ago with the Republic. But then there's also another unionist aspect to this, which I'm just astonished, or maybe I shouldn't be astonished, because lots of MPs don't really understand the history or the complexity of it, and don't necessarily have connections with Northern Ireland, and not necessarily what they were, because in the past quite often a lot of MPs would have served there, or there would have been a dialogue and a historical understanding. But if you say to a certain kind of Ulster unionist, oh look, there's been a vote in the Republic on abortion, I mean, that is the worst, for them, that is the worst possible prompting to change the law in Northern Ireland. That is essentially saying there's been a vote in another country, therefore, because you're on the same island. I mean, that cuts right to the very heart of what Northern Ireland unionism is about.
I think
the argument is for Northern Ireland, ultimately, but I don't... And there is a sensitivity there around maybe some Conservative MPs getting too far. But I think a lot of it was just making quite a direct response to what happened in the Republic of Ireland, and then drawing out a kind of contradiction there, that there's been a free vote on abortion in the Republic. There hasn't been in Northern Ireland. That's something that could resolve. There's nothing wrong in stating that, I don't think. And that's what I think it mostly was just saying... These rights are universal rights for women. In one part of our country, they're not respected. I don't think that. And the Supreme Court ruling confirms that there is, like, there's a body of, like, legislative stuff there that supports that view.
I completely agree. And I think another dynamic that's at play here, it's very interesting you say that, is you're completely right that, you know, a classic Ulster unionist would be shocked by the idea that because the Republic of Ireland did something, that should... instill it in Northern Ireland. But obviously a lot of this, like, social progressive movements in Ireland have come from the youth population, yeah, which is large and very socially liberal and very active and very political. And from growing up in Dublin myself, I've realised among my friends now there is a growing sentiment of nationalism, and there is a stronger sense of, you know, wanting a united Ireland. And I would imagine that there's probably a similar thing going on with young people in Northern Ireland, which, you know, could be dangerous for Arlene Foster and the unionism that she believes so strongly in, because, as was pointed out lots of times, if Northern Ireland doesn't grant these women these rights, you know, they're going to start looking to Dublin.
So what, I think a unionism worth its salt integrates, for example, those notions of rights into it. You know, like, for example, unionism in Scotland has always been, I think, a highly progressive thing that is against being, I don't know what to call it, backwards or uber traditional.
Conservative, yeah.
So I think that can be part of the public argument. Mm. You know, if you acknowledge that, like, control over, for example, like the freedom to choose what you do with your body is something that is the centre of what politics is, then why can't a more successful unionism integrate that? Why does it have to be an Ulster unionism?
Yeah, but I mean, when in the earliest period of the, at the time of the Jacobite rebellions, and those times when, you know, that period when Scottish Enlightenment figures were involved in anti-Jacobite activities and were pro-Hanoverian, you're right, the Union was seen as the modernising force. So the Hanoverian approach was, you know, everything was being modernised, whether that was political thought, a new way of thinking about politics and economics was being invented, agriculture, building, design, art, money, banking, all of that was intrinsically Hanoverian. I think, though, what troubles me about the rhetoric since the, and I'm not a pro-DUP person, although I'm a unionist, and I disagree with the DUP on a lot, I really, really dislike a lot of the rhetoric, particularly in London, about the DUP. They've been described in really quite a lot of mainstream, otherwise sensible media, in terms that you wouldn't expect almost any other political grouping in the modern era to be described as. You know, if that language was used in relation to any other minority group, there'd be court cases, or there'd certainly be the outrage. But because it's the DUP, and because, you know, they do and say some funny things and look odd as far as most people living in London, or certainly in Westminster or in the media, think, then there's just a license to take the piss and be really quite contemptuous.
I think that's a really good point, and I think you're actually pointing or indicating towards like actually a larger trend in the otherwise sensible media, as you call it, about general rhetoric about Irish politics as a whole. And some of the stuff that's said about the DUP, I completely agree. But then you think about the way that they treat someone like Varadkar as well, as like he's cast as this young, naive, you know, out of his depth, we need to help him kind of figure, which is not the way that, you know, the media would be talking about any other European politician who's, you know, trying his best to negotiate.
Yeah. And Ireland is a young, naive country.
I think.
But then that wouldn't. But the curiosity there is, so is that maybe because, and I know you quite like him, is that maybe because that's an accurate portrait of him to an extent? So someone like Enda Kenny was highly respected in the UK. I mean, you know, you go back through Bruton, and you go back through the peace process, that take party out of it, Irish politicians were seen during the peace process and the years after as serious, serious partners, as grown-ups, and very often more grown-up than some of the British politicians are called.
Yeah, but very possibly. I guess I'm too young to really know much about how they were treated in the peace processes. But, you know, you look at even Bertie Ahern, you know, was again characterised as this kind of, you know, slippery but also slightly foolish kind of country bumpkin figure.
I don't know.
Bertie.
He doesn't help himself, is he?
But it's interesting. I mean, I know that he was a controversial figure in Irish politics.
Flirty Bertie.
In terms of his. We're not having a discussion, Alistair, about taking Irish politics seriously, and you and your sort of.
You're the
Scottish patrician way you're taking the piss. But he was seen as, you know, hail fellow, well met, but always very sharp.
I think Varadkar. Yes, I'm sure that, you know, you can look at those criticisms and wonder if they're true. But I disagree. I think he's handling Brexit very well. He's, you know, being quite straightforward and forceful, and saying, this isn't something that we asked for our country. We didn't vote for Brexit, so we want to minimise the negative impacts as far as possible that Brexit will have on us. Which is, you know,
My view that Leo Varadkar is portrayed as a naive national embarrassment to the Irish is flattened there by Finn. You know, I think he's portrayed like that because that's what he is. But you disagree.
Yeah,
so we agree to disagree. And I am conscious I'm 25 minutes of the podcast. You've got weekend stuff to finish, Alistair. I've got the weekend newsletter to write. We've got the site to do. So I think we're probably going to go short this week. Mm. Thank you, those of you who are listening. Apologies for noise in the background, which just shows it's authentic. We are in a fantastic Italian cafe. What did I? Alistair had tiramisu. Mm. Finn didn't have anything. I had far too much pistachio and cherry ice cream, and it was delicious. And we'll see you next week.